Shortly before his death, Vladimir Nabokov left strict instructions with his wife to burn the manuscript he was working on if he was unable to complete it. And he didn't finish it, but she ignored his wishes. Now, 32 years later, with the permission of Nabokov's only child, Dmitri, the unfinished novel, The Original of Laura, is being published by Knopf, incomplete and presented as a collection of index cards written in pencil in Nabokov's neat hand. There's also a text underneath the index cards for those of us who can't read even the neatest of handwritings. Joining me now are Brian Boyd, Mr. Nabokov's biographer.
Hi.
And Chip Kidd, the award-winning designer who put the book together. And
hello.
I'm pleased to welcome the two of you back to our show.
Yeah, thank you.
Great to be here.
Brian, there's been a lot of fuss about this book. Would it be published? Should it be published? What did Dmitri Nabokov decide to release it against his father's wishes, and why now?
I first read it in 1987 after years of imploring Vera to let me see it, and they put the question to me what to do with it then, and I actually told them to destroy it then. But I'm glad they didn't heed me.
And why did you tell him to destroy it? Because when I think back historically, Kafka requested that his manuscripts be destroyed, and that was ignored by Max Brod to everyone's gratitude.
Yeah, but the castle and the trial were a lot more finished than The Original of Laura, and a lot more substantial. I've just been reading a lot of the reviews that have come in over the last couple of days by people like John Banville and Martin Amis, and their misgivings about the book are very closely akin to my misgivings when I first read it, although I had to read it under Vera Nabokov's eye, sitting across her narrow little living room, and I was allowed to read it once only, take no notes, and I knew I was going to have to write about it in the biography. I mean, it was super stressful. How could I possibly have liked it, I think? But I had such a strong negative reaction, and partly because of a Lolita theme that seemed to me just one post-Lolita repetition too many.
Hubbard becomes Hubert.
Yes, and that's something that John Banville and Martin Amis and other reviewers have picked up on and felt squeamish about. And I mean, I thought, no, it clearly is a long way from finished, and Nabokov would have been appalled. So all those things together made me suggest destroying it, which took. I was really flabbergasted to hear myself say that because, you know, I had almost trembled with excitement the first time I'd held a Nabokov manuscript in my hand.
Well, why did Vera, his widow, decide not to burn it?
She adored everything he did and everything he wrote. She kept any every scrap of, you know, if he'd ever had to stoop to writing a shopping list, she would have kept it, and. And
there's another book there, Chip.
I'm game. Bring it on.
Yeah, she just treasured everything he did too much to destroy it. And Dmitri was the same. And I think both of them, they were very closely attuned readers of Nabokov's work and saw in it what he was seeing in it, even though he didn't get to express all that he had seen. I think Dmitri was interested from... He kept on asking me from time to time when I'd see him in Montreux, and I had toned down my response. I just said, don't destroy it, but just preserve it, but don't publish it. This will mean it'll get published eventually, but it won't be your responsibility. And then in 98, at a slightly premature Nabokov Centenary Festival in Cornell, he surprised everybody by reading a little chunk from Laura. And then the next year, there was a Nabokov writer-like contest in the Nabokovian. I don't know if you've heard about this.
I wouldn't even dare to try to write.
Yeah,
like Nabokov.
Well, but some people did, and they picked the three best and put them in the journal, along with two pieces sent by Dmitri that were said to be, you know, were his father's work, and he didn't say that they were from Laura. There wasn't anything in it to indicate that it was, or that they were, and they were all anonymous, you had to choose which was the most likely to be Nabokov's, and nobody picked the two Laura passages. I think that's fascinating. Mm.
Chip, you've designed instantly recognizable book covers for many literary greats. Mm-hmm. McCarthy's No Country for Old Men, The Skull Smoking the Cigarette for David Sedaris's When You're Engulfed in Frames, Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park. But mm-hmm. I suspect coming up with those iconic images was not anything near the challenge you faced in putting a book together out of 138 index cards.
Correct. I mean, first of all, I have to say what a huge Nabokov fan I am. And I was thrilled beyond measure when Sonny Maida called me into his office mysteriously and said, okay, this is what I want you to do. And I, of course, knew of the work. I didn't know what it was, but I knew of it. And so I was jumping up and down. I mean, I'm gonna design the last first Nabokov edition. I would just put out there as a Nabokov fan as a designer, you know, artists publish sketchbooks all the time, and it's not a problem.
These are unfinished works.
Hello.
And they allow us to see the way they think.
Correct. So that is how I approached this. And Nabokov just happened to be an artist with words. So I very much was looking at this as an artifact. And there were all sorts of concepts bandied about, you know, packaging these as cards with a booklet that would go with it that does the typescript. And
you knew from the start where the sequence of cards?
Well, see, this was the thing. They are numbered up into a point where they're not anymore. And so that became, to me, the germ of the idea of doing a punch-out book. Now, when I was growing up, a punch-out book was like my favorite thing in the whole world. And I had like the Batman punch-out book where everything's perforated and you've got all the characters and the things and the stuff and you punch them out and you move them around. And I loved that because it brought them out of two dimensions into three. And so with these cards, I wanted at least put in place the concept that the reader could rearrange them because that's what Nabokov would do. And so I said, let's perforate them. Let's do this in a, what we call a D format book, which is what we did the complete stories in. So this will sit along next to that on your bookshelf comfortably. And let's do it on heavier paper, like cardstock. And let's perforate them so that people can punch them out and move them around. And
that didn't happen.
What do you mean?
Well, the book I have, am I punching this out?
You can.
I can.
If you want
oh,
to.
Gosh, I can. I can.
Oh, shame on
you.
Can't
do it.
No. One of the interesting things you did is you addressed this whole issue on the cover of the hardcover. We have the sleeve, which doesn't give any indication, but when you pull the sleeve away, we read in Nabokov's handwriting. Efface, expunge, erase, delete, rub out, wipe out, obliterate, and then there is something else that just scribbled over.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it's all about, and that's what the story is about. And, I mean, people seem – within Knopf, people seem to like the perforation idea, but there was a lot of hand-wringing about it. And, I mean, it was more money, but that wasn't really the issue. It was sort of like, well, are people really going to punch these cards out? and I said, look, probably not.
But they have the option.
But they can, and it's the concept. And then you run your hand over it. It's like, oh, it's perforated. I could punch this out.
Now, Brian, is it clear as to the sequence in the later parts of the book?
No. I was surprised actually when I read it, and as I reread it, how much of a finished sequence there is right at the beginning. The first five chapters are pretty much in place.
Is that because he got ill? He was getting iller and iller as he continued to work on the book?
Yes, well, he certainly was. I'm not sure whether this would have been the normal pattern for him or not, or whether he had got to a stage where the most he could do was kind of finalize the beginning. But it is clear that I think that there is a middle of the parts about Philip Wilde erasing himself into death, as it were, and there's an end Laura finding the book of Laura and deciding not to read about her wonderful death. But there are cards that follow that, and there's certainly a lot of uncertainty between those three chunks. Everything apart from those three chunks could be placed in a number of different sequences. And even the very first card, which I think it's a wonderful beginning, but there's a card about page 189 that could be inserted in that first thing, but you'd have to change things. So, yeah.
My guest is Brian Boyd, Nabokov's biographer, and Chip Kidd, the graphic designer responsible for the final product, the original of Laura by Vladimir Nabokov, is published by Knopp. Well, did he always work that way with index cards?
From about the late 40s, I think I think the first novel he started to write that way was Lolita. He had got to using index cards when he was a lepidopterist at the Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology, and he'd be using it for research purposes. He'd always written by hand. He never learned how to type, and he would usually just work over a manuscript till it was a virtually illegible palimpsest and then dictate it to Vera. But as he discovered, index cards allowed him to work in any order he liked
and move things around.
In. Yeah, so he said that he had a vision of something in a kind of timeless, in a spatial form almost, and he could just rub any part of the canvas to make it brighter and insert the cards for that.
So who determined the final sequencing in this edition?
Well, certainly not me.
Was it Dimitri?
It must have been.
Yeah.
It had been.
As far as I recall, the sequence was found in the box, and it was preserved when it was first, when it was transcribed or when it was... I think there were transcriptions that were given number stamps on them just to fix the order as they were found. So I think it is pretty much one hopes that it's the order in which it was found. Certainly when Vera was watching me read, I wasn't allowed to reshuffle anything.
Well, so what is the story here ultimately? Why is it called the original of Laura? I throw this out to either of you.
Yeah.
No, I was going to make a joke because it makes the acronym of Tool.
Well, in fact, and at one stage while he was writing it, Nabokov said to Fred Hills, his publisher at McGraw-Hill, that he was going well on the original of Laura, which he had retitled and was calling it the original of Laura now. Which formed an acronym Tool, and he wasn't sure whether he was more pleased about the novel or the acronym.
and that's the way his mind worked.
and he had for his previous novel, Look at the Harlequins. He also had an acronym Lath, which is like the Harlequins Lath, and that was deliberately built into the structure. And I'm not sure if there was a point to that acronym Tool.
But we don't want to hammer this home.
Yeah.
Because if we screw around with it anymore, it's going to get tart.
It's an old song.
Flora, one of the main characters, attracts the attentions of an older man named Hubert H. Hubert. And that did, as you said, upset some people. It seems like almost a cheap joke on himself.
Well, I think it's actually a very a sly deception on against the reader. The reader expects that it's another Humbert reprise. But if you read it carefully, and this wasn't how I read it first, and it's not how reviewers are reading, but if you read it carefully, I think it becomes clear that although Hubert feels tenderly towards Flora, it's really the fact that she's the same age as his daughter was when she died at 12, and he just wants to, in a way, hold his daughter again, be near his daughter. And, of course, Flora is somebody for whom love is a difficult word. She's very into sex, hasn't yet lost her virginity at 12, but she sees him as a dirty old man. And the reader, because of those Hubert H. Hubert and other cues, is inclined to see him as a Humbert, but he's not actually. She kicks him in the groin and fends him off, and it's a wonderful scene of farce. But in fact, as I'll be saying tonight at the 92nd Street Y, I think the real link with Lolita, the novel, is not with, with Humbert's behavior towards Lolita, but with a wonderful little vignette that Nabokov had where Humbert goes to a barber who gives him a very bad haircut, and the barber is talking about this baseball-playing son of his, and Humbert's thinking his own thoughts and then realizes that the son he's referring to has been dead for 30 years. And it's that a parent's love for a child that... It's almost the only moment of tenderness we get in the whole of the original of Laura, and Nabokov has set us up to read it the wrong way.
Now, if this book were just set in type straight, it would be 100 pages. So there's an awful lot of guessing, isn't there, as to what his intentions were? Did he ever talk to anybody about that?
There's a wonderful piece that he wrote for the New York Times in October 76, after he had been feverish all summer and hospitalized, and he was asked what his reading had been over the summer, and he mentioned the Singleton's translation of Dante and Howe's new book on the butterflies of North America, and he said he had been reading his unwritten novel to an audience that consisted of his dead mother and father, pigeons, peacocks, some crouching nurses, and so on, and... He says that their response wasn't too favorable, perhaps because he was stumbling and coughing too much. But that's a wonderful little description. Clearly, he hasn't lost too many of his powers when he writes this. He never gave any other indications. So there are titles that he might have used, like Dying is Fun, which is used as the subtitle on the title page in this version, but not on the cover.
Because he's writing a lot about death while he's dying.
Yeah.
And he's writing still in English, even though he could have returned to Russian, couldn't he?
He could have, but...
Well, because his mother would have understood better.
No, well, yes, but his mother would have understood English perfectly well, too. In fact, she used to read him English fairy tales in the English...
Beyond coming up with this idea of punch-out cards, you had to think about how to best serve this novel.
Right, especially with the jacket.
The jacket? Did you look at other previous Nabokov jackets?
Well, I was certainly aware of previous Nabokov jackets. I think what the key to this was to make it as simple as possible, but also give it something that was unique. And
the type is disappearing.
Well, yes, it is, and if you look at the title page, it's the same concept, only it's white, and that was my first idea, was to fade out to this white void, and because a lot of his covers had white background, and Sonny sort of suggested, well, that's an interesting idea, but why don't you try black? And that was almost as much a logistical thing as it was an aesthetic thing.
Now, just one more thing. Suspicions of some people. There's always a suspicious person out there. And a listener left a comment on our show page saying, let us not pretend that this is about art, literature, or preservation. It's about money.
Well, they're really an up person, aren't they?
I mean, I think it is partly about money. Nabokov used to quote Pushkin, who was his favorite poet, and say, "I write for pleasure and I publish for money." And Nabokov himself used to draw these wonderfully elaborate butterflies on the covers of his on the title pages of his books for Vera and Dmitri, partly as a legacy for Dmitri.
The 92nd Street Y Center is hosting a celebration of Nabokov's work this evening. Find out if tickets are still available by looking at 92y.org, or you can go to our show page, and 12 of the original index cards will be on display before they're auctioned at Christie's. My great thanks to my two guests, Brian Boyd and Chip Kidd. Thank you.